Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Garth Ammett. He is a local chiropractor here in Grand Rapids, and he's also very active in the LDS Church. We've been discussing the LDS Church in the 21st century, the changes that he's seen since he was a youth, and let me tell you a little bit about Garth. He's been living in Grand Rapids since 1982. He is an ordained high priest of the LDS. His father was a bishop in the LDS Church in the 1960s. He served a two-year mission in Bordeaux, France, and he served in a variety of callings, including bishop of the Wyoming-Michigan ward, and he also served on the Grand Rapids Stake High Council, which is the equivalent of a diocese here in West Michigan. And he has had a keen interest in theology, Christian apologetics, and evangelism. And he is also a member of the Interfaith Dialogue Association Speakers Bureau. So many times in the past few years when churches and schools and colleges have contacted us and said, we want to learn a little bit more about Mormonism, we send them Garth. And we've always gotten very positive feedback. So we welcome once again to Common Threads, Garth Ammett. Hello.
Hello. Thank you, Fred.
Certainly. So to recap what we did last week, in case anybody might have missed it, we're talking about the contemporary Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the changes that you may have seen last week. We talked about the changes in missionary activity, what one did as a missionary back in your day in the 60s, 70s is somewhat different from how people work today. What I want to talk about now is, well, you know, we touched on something last week. Just for a moment, I want to have a conversation here. The Book of Mormon, not the book, the play. I have to say, I was thoroughly impressed. I attended a workshop, an interfaith workshop, at a seminary in Connecticut a couple of years ago. And we had presentations by various religions and various denominations of religions over the week, and some LDS folks came in, and they gave it their shot. And I asked them about the play, and none of them had seen it, but they talked about it. They put the best face on the situation, I think, that was appropriate. And they told me that the church has even bought advertising space in the programs that would say something like, you've seen the play, now read the book, which I thought was like the best way to possibly respond to something like this. My hat's off to you as a denomination for doing that. What has been, if you can speak to this, the collective response? Obviously, you know, these ads have been taken out. The best of my knowledge, there haven't been mass protests on Broadway. What's your take on it?
Well, I haven't seen it because it is starting to tour, but and it will be here in Grand Rapids, I think, in this coming season. But so having not seen it, all I know is the clips I've watched. I'm curious about it. So I went on YouTube and I typed in, you know, watched a couple of the clips. I busted a gut. I thought they were hysterical. I understand it's also kind of foul-mouthed, and you know, you can't expect the South Park atheistic writers to exactly embrace any religion, and they certainly have not embraced Mormonism. But I guess my attitude is, you know what? We live in a plural society. There should not be some monolithic view of anything, whether we like it or not, people are curious. In fact, the year that Mitt Romney ran, speaking of the Interfaith Dialogue, I think I did 15 presentations at different colleges and churches, whereas in a typical year, it's two or three.
Sure.
So people are naturally curious, and I have no problem with the Book of Mormon concept as a musical. How they execute it, since I haven't seen it, I don't know.
If you do go, do you get a discount?
You know, I should. With all the tithing I've paid over the years, I should get at least 10% off. But I doubt that they probably will charge me more because they probably figure I'll be there snickering, but which I may be. But yeah, I think the church handles criticism pretty well because goodness knows we're used to it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that brings us to the opening of the Mormon faith in their attitudes more. I would admit, and I think most Mormons who are well-schooled in their theology recognize that because we're a proselyting church, we want to give a good impression. We want people to be interested and therefore consider us. We think we can add something to people's lives in many cases, or we wouldn't be a proselyting church. So in that sense, I think the church has felt, well, if there's anything that's not easily explained, let's just leave it alone. And that has had to change. The internet has forced that change, if nothing else, because people can now say, well, wait a minute, what about this and what about that? And what was the nature of this historical moment? And so the church has, I think, made a wise decision in the last 5 years to not just give a good presentation, but open ourselves up to the fact that we're not going to be necessarily embraced and loved by all. So let's tackle it head on and let's confront it. So the church in the last year has released at least three, I would say, white papers and posted them on LDS.org about the Mormon attitude of priesthood and its former denial of priesthood ordination to blacks. They've also posted a article on polygamy, which is probably what the church has been most mysterious about for many, many decades. And because of the current trend in LGBT issues, the church has had to confront that, both with our stance on Boy Scouts, which the Boy Scouts have had to confront, as well as Proposition 8 in California, where there were picketers and rioters, and Mormons, I know, lost jobs over that because simply they were members of the church. So, yeah, it's been a thorny issue, and I'm sure as the world spirals in, I think, a downward direction, we're going to see that if you stand out and are peculiar, you're going to either break or bend, and I think the church has realized better to bend and control the conversation a little bit by honestly and objectively discussing our view of it.
I wasn't aware that polygamy was mysterious. The concept.
Well, that's probably a
how
odd
was
term.
It? How was it handled, and how is it handled?
Well, the church put out a white paper, as I said, that came out recently and confronted it on all aspects from its early beginnings in the Mormon faith. To the fact that some groups have broken off from the Mormon church and still practice polygamy. Our church abandoned it officially in 1890 with an official declaration that we would no longer practice polygamy. Part of that was because what had not been illegal before in courts and in jurisdictions of American government became illegal. So then the church faced a very real conflict of, do we obey the law of the land, which we also believe in, mm-hmm. or do we continue to practice polygamy? The church made the decision in 1890 that we would no longer perform polygamous marriages, either in the United States or outside. Now, there were Mormons who already had a polygamous marriage, and those we figured, as they do for every human being, would die out. There were groups who broke off from the Mormon church over that very conflict. And some groups who later restarted the conflict by saying, well, we still want to practice polygamy. These are small, little groups. The most famous one was that FLDS group in Texas.
Sure.
Where their prophet was found guilty of some terribly heinous things and is currently in jail. So our group has had nothing to do with polygamy since 1890. So it's in that context, we've had to confront, well, what was the history? What was the doctrinal reason for polygamy? And how does that jive with the church that claims to be directed by a living prophet when we had to confront the, do we obey the law of the land or do we obey what we view as an approved law of God? We felt that, well, since it's not mandatory, let's obey the law of the land. So polygamy stopped. And when I say mysterious, I mean more, we probably have never really discussed the origins or the early part of polygamy, except for scholars who, it's always been there. It's not hidden, but the church certainly doesn't go out of its way to bring up polygamy simply because, A, it's not pertinent anymore, unless you've been alive since 1890, and that would be very unusual. Why bother? Mm-hmm. But yeah, we also recognize that people want to know, well, if you claim to be the true church, why would you have a untrue doctrine? And the simple answer I would say is we don't claim it was an untrue doctrine. We look at it more from the historical sense that just as God approved and, in fact, even commanded polygamy under certain circumstances, and Christ, in fact, descends from if you go far enough back, Ruth is a example of a polygamous descendant that led to the descendancy of Jesus Christ. And, of course, we have David and Solomon, and these men were not condemned for having polygamous wives. In fact, David was even told when he was rebuked for taking the wife of another man, if you had wanted more wives, I would have given them to you. So how does that jive with God being an eternal being who always commands in one direction? So our historical perspective is the part I mean that's mysterious because we just didn't really bring it up. But since others have and want to know about it, the church addresses it. And if people are curious, go to LDS.org, and I think it's obviously there. You can just look it up and read it for yourself.
And what was it that we just read within the last couple of weeks that has been made more open?
Yes, that's the translation of the Book of Mormon. When the Book of Mormon was translated, and we may be diving into waters that we haven't filled the font for yet for people who aren't familiar with it, but if I may just back up a second so listeners
by all means,
that.
Go right ahead.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon faith, is called Mormon because we believe in an additional book of Scripture, a companion, we view it, to the Bible, which is called the Book of Mormon. And that recounts a story of Israelites who left ancient Israel in around 600 BC and traveled here, were led here by God, we believe, and basically established a colony here in the Americas. The history of that people runs from 600 BC to about 420 AD. So a thousand-year period of time during which, much like the Old Testament, we have wars and prophets, and the keystone moment of the Book of Mormon is a recounting of Christ resurrected appearing to the people on this continent.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that story is one that obviously had to get here, and we believe it was delivered to a young man named Joseph Smith, who received the plates that had been archived by this ancient civilization, and therefore the Book of Mormon, how it was translated and came to be, is a story within Mormonism. And so the recent release was a original manuscript, the actual handwritten manuscript, which there were, I believe, only three copies of, one destroyed through weather, left in a cornerstone of a building in Nauvoo and basically dissolved, one owned by the Church of Christ, which is a breakoff from the Mormon Church, used to be called the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and then this third copy that the church has had but has never released. So now they've released it. And as I understand it, I actually haven't gone online to look at it yet, but it has a dual page. One side has the original writing, and the other side has the version of the Book of Mormon that would be in print. So people can go and look and see it with their own eyes. Along with that was released, and this is the only controversial thing, that really wasn't controversial, but was released a picture of a stone, I mean a literal stone, that Joseph Smith apparently used in part of the translation. That would be far over a half hour to explain that, but because that picture of a stone, a method that was used for Joseph Smith to receive the literal words that would then be read to the scribe and written down and become that manuscript, because that is so unusual, the church has not discussed how it was done. In fact, frankly, we don't really know how it was done. Joseph Smith himself never left a description. So we have only those who have seen him translate, and that's a handful, two, three, four people. And usually they left a paragraph. So because of this, releasing pictures of the stone that we think was used, among other items that were used to do it, is, I don't know if it's controversial, but it certainly is newsworthy.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella. Garth Emmett is our guest today, and we're talking about Mormonism. So do you think with the release of what you've just told us about the manuscript, about the stone, is that ammunition for people who are in opposition to you? Or do you think that it is, forgive the term, ammunition for you to say, see, this indicates veracity of what we've been saying all along?
Well, that's a good question. It's only been a short period of time, and I don't know how that will play out. The church has always had detractors. I would say the Christian church has always had detractors. Before Paul was Saul, he did his best to try to destroy the church, and all based on theological principles that he viewed as absolutely rock-solidly true. I personally have had a love of Mormon apologetics for 25 years. And I have lunch at least 3-4 times a year with a group of very zealous, very dedicated. They don't like to be called anti-Mormon. They're my friends, so mm-hmm. I usually defer to their preference as theologians. But they are. They don't like the Mormon church. But we have a great relationship. What I have found is if someone is intellectually honest, you can make a case either direction. I think the manuscript of the Book of Mormon supports the Book of Mormon. It was translated and brought to fruition in a space of 30 days. This is a 521-page book with extreme movements of groups and subgroups, with prophetic visions, with profound teachings. One critic recently said, well, the one thing I'll say about the Book of Mormon, it's more Jesus-y than the Bible, because it has so much references, over 1,000 references to Jesus Christ, more than the New Testament. So I think the Book of Mormon is evidence and has evidence that support it. So whether or not the picture of a stone that may have been used, what we call a seer stone, in how it was translated, I suppose if, you know, I don't know how it worked, but I know how my cell phone works, and I know that gives me messages and a little thing I hold in my hand, so I would assume God has some way of doing it too. So how it will play out in the public's eye, I honestly don't know.
When you talk about getting together with people who are your friends who would be in opposition with you theologically, last week you mentioned something. You said if you take an evangelical Christian who really lives his faith, and you take a Mormon who really lives his faith, you're not gonna tell the difference. What I find interesting in the world of multi-religious conversations is, well, I always say that religion has two aspects: the transcendent and the mundane. And the mundane is just how we live our lives. What guidelines have been passed down, what traditions have been passed down to allow us to lead whole lives. Then there's the transcendent. The transcendent is belief-oriented. What happens in the afterlife, the nature of God, angels, whatever, okay? That we have a very hard time proving. And unfortunately, that's what most people argue about, is the unprovable. But you can really prove the mundane. You can prove that if you live your life in a certain way, you're going to be more fulfilled. You might even have a longer lifespan, if that's any indication of a bonus, that families are stronger, et cetera, et cetera. So when you have your conversations with people who walk a different walk, they don't see that. Or that isn't important to them, because what's really important is what happens after.
I would say those who have a theological foundation care probably more about the theology of Mormonism and therefore criticize the theology of Mormonism. They don't. In fact, it's rather interesting that they begrudgingly tell us that, boy, we sure love the way you people live your religion. Without naming names, I will say that one of my dearest anti-Mormon friends gave me an interesting reason why he could not vote for Mitt Romney. And I'm paraphrasing it. I hope I don't do him a disservice. But he basically said, well, I'm not going to vote for Mitt Romney in the next election because I'm concerned that because he is such a good man and because he lives such an exemplary life, people will be attracted to Mormonism. And I'm much more concerned about them going to hell than I am about the country going to heaven. And therefore, I can't vote for Mitt Romney because it would risk the fact that more people would be attracted to just how great your church operates and functions. So I'm not going to vote for him. And I had to go, well, okay, thank you. But it was kind of a backhanded compliment, and I understand where he's going. So there would be someone who is, you know, as far as the theological side, they would put that preeminent. I think, on the other hand, you're right, that people who want to live a good life and want to see others who are happy and fulfilled, they don't really have complaints about the Mormon lifestyle as a general rule.
So I realize this might be old news, but maybe the fact that I'm asking this for more than, goodness gracious, I'm asking this maybe 7 years, excuse me, after the fact. How did the Romney campaign and the bid, his nomination for President of the United States and the Republican Party, how did that affect the church as a whole, if you can speak to that?
Well, when Mitt and I chatted last, I haven't chatted with him yet. But certainly, I was a keen observer of it, and I personally am a conservative, and I had mixed feelings. On one hand, I thought, okay, as soon as you become president of the United States, approximately 50% of the Americans hate your guts because you're in the other party. So immediately, you have to consider that a Mormon in the White House means 50% of the people are not going to be looking at the church favorably because they don't look at the president favorably. He could be Amish, you know, he could be Buddhist, he could be anything, and they're going to automatically presume that because I don't like his party and he is of a faith that I don't know anything about, I must not like his faith either. So I would say I had concerns that, unlike my friend who thought that it would attract people, my thought was, well, it's probably going to give us more hassle. And I don't like hassle. I don't want to be, you know, having to answer, oh, well, why did your president send troops into such and such place? Are you Mormons warmongers? And the fact that, well, it has nothing to do with his faith, that was his political decision, probably would be called into question. So I had mixed feelings. I thought he'd be good for the country as a conservative. I thought he would meet the needs of the country best. So I supported him. But beyond that, I can't say I thought it was great for the church. I think the church got more attention.
Yes, it did. Well, you mentioned before that you had a whole slew of speaking engagements
right
back then.
So I think in that sense it got more attention. Whether that attention, I suppose if he had been another Ronald Reagan, well-loved in generations to come, maybe it would have been a favorable. We'll never know now.
I heard someone once said that they were talking about different religions, and Mormonism was in this litany. And honestly, I can't even tell you what the other ones were. They said, it's a great religion as long as you are a round peg. All of the round pegs flourish. But right. Boy, if you're a square peg, it's really, really hard to fit in. As we are going into the 21st century, how do you see the church responding to those people who want to remain in the church,
right,
but are challenged either because of their gender identity, their politics, their quest for truth and being able to look at the tradition honestly and perhaps dissent if they see something that they just don't like? Is there any more? Well, you may say, you know something, Fred, there's been accommodation all along. Or you may say, well, maybe we haven't treated people who are square pegs as well as we should have, but we're doing this or that. Where would you fall along in that?
I'd be with a foot in both camps. I think that we have to acknowledge that if you accommodate too much, then you no longer have the core that made you what you are. I've seen that in some other denominations where you have to question, are they still even really centered in biblical theology? So on one hand, I firmly believe in doctrine. What I don't believe in is dogma. I don't believe in groupthink, me personally. I probably would be considered among most of my Mormon friends to be a fairly progressive Mormon, not politically, but it, certainly in theology. We have always taught in the church that we only see in a mirror darkly. We don't have full knowledge of almost anything. So to be flexible is key. We need to accommodate people of all walks of life and of all persuasions. On the other hand, we need to also have certain standards, traditions, beliefs that are not up for vote. So the church, I think ours and other churches, are all trying to struggle with how do you accommodate. I've heard of some churches that try to accommodate literal atheists. And there comes a point where I say, you're probably going a little too far there. So where that line is, we are feeling for ourselves. We do have members that have left the church because they didn't feel comfortable. And we've had other people who've joined the church because they haven't found the core beliefs in their own faith. And they're looking for that originalism, I guess you'd say.
Mm-hmm. We're coming down to the wire for this edition of Common Threads. And last week, I neglected to ask you this, so I'm going to give you the opportunity now. If people in Grand Rapids are interested in learning more about the local community of LDS, where could they go, web-wise, otherwise?
Well, there's two main websites. The first and main site would be LDS.org. Mm-hmm. The second would be Mormon.org, M-O-R-M-O-N. And then along the way, we have lots of other sub-bars and sub-places. You can click here and you'll go to providentliving.org, which is all about food storage and canning and kind of, I guess you'd say, the Dave Ramsey side of our church. So that would be the main three areas, I would say, main two, the first two I mentioned.
Okay. Well, Garth, I appreciate your time this week and last week as well.
Thank you, Fred. I appreciate the opportunity.
You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella. Garth Amit has been our guest, and we've been discussing Mormonism this week and last. Please join us again next week for another edition of Common Threads.